Even the way it was constructed, the way it was negotiated, the way that it was really centered around lobbying by big corporate interests rather than the public interest starts wrong. The fact that corporations have the power for a dispute resolution mechanism where they have power over governments, over our courts, is again wrong. The fact that the environmental certainty we want around protecting environmental rights is not clarified, is not given real certainty within the treaty, is wrong. We do need to negotiate trade and kind of global cooperation in a better way, and the European Union should be standing for that, and Ireland is a member country.
Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we are talking CETA. You have just heard Eamon Ryan speaking to Niall Sargent, who was at the time the editor of the Green News, and he was pretty unequivocal about his fears and how he thought how CETA, the Comprehensive Economic Trade Agreement between Canada and Europe, was structured and was wrong. We will be diving into that now shortly with our guest, Green MEP, Ciarán Cuff. But before I do that, I would please plead with you, in the run-up to Christmas, I know people are pushed for cash and all sorts of demands, but we would love to go into 2021 with a little more certainty, a little more viability. We need you guys to help us out. There are literally thousands of you listening. So if some of you could please put your hands in your pocket, head over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. There's a range of tiers there. There's loads of additional content and there's a lot more fun to be had. We are very responsive over there. If you could please see if there's a tier that suits you, it would really, really help us. And thank you so much to the people who have done. We just need more of you to really help us. This platform costs a lot of money to put out, a lot of time, a lot of effort, and it's a lot bigger than it was 12 months ago. I'm delighted to be joined on the line now by Ciarán Cuff, Green Party MEP, and a member of the European Forum for Renewable Energy Sources. Ciarán, how are you keeping?
I'm keeping well. Here in Stonybatter, as opposed to Strasbourg. So maybe a little bit less glamorous than tearing around Europe all the time, but the work goes on, you know.
Yeah. Look, we better get straight into it. It has been a tumultuous few days. It's been a tumultuous few months for the Green Party since they entered government, but specifically around the CETA agreement. Listeners will have heard your party leader, Eamon Ryan, talk about it and describe it in no uncertain terms as something that he was opposed to. And yet now it is the position of the party leader that it needs to be ratified. Ciarán, you're a member of the European Greens, in effect. What is the position in terms of the EU Greens?
Well, the view of the European Greens and of the Greens in the European Parliament is that we are opposed to CETA. We don't see enough commitment to environmental standards and workers' rights. We have concerns about the investor court, the way you resolve disputes within the trade deal. But look, I don't think there's any trade deal that the Greens would be 100% happy with. And, you know, in the past, we were very vocal in our criticism of CETA, of TTIP, and indeed of the proposed Mercosur trade deal. These are essentially trade deals. Yes, they're about, you know, helping small companies and individuals work and trade abroad, but they're also about the big boys. They're about big companies being able to sell stuff across the world. And whenever that happens, I think you will always find Greens with concerns about what is being proposed.
Just on the... To go straight into it, though, I mean, the Greens now, I'm sure you've seen the briefing document about why it's been done. And the claim is that in the programme for government, while it wasn't explicitly mentioned, that it was, you know, support EU trade deals, you know, future and existing. I put it to you that CETA is actually not a trade deal. It's a mixed international agreement. And that is the case. That is absolutely the case. Alice Mary Higgins, first time she presented in the Shannon, was to say it was a mixed agreement, and as such, it's not covered in the program for government.
Look, I think you can argue it both ways, Tony. My understanding is it is a trade deal, and trade deals are mentioned in several places within the program for government. We'll support new and existing EU trade deals to expand Ireland's export options into new markets. So I think it is a trade deal. And look, government isn't exactly a party for everybody. It's you have to take the rough with the smooth, and there will always be policy differences between yourself and your colleagues in government. And I don't want to, you know, skate over that and say, I think it's a brilliant deal. I don't. And I think it's a tough call for my colleagues who are in the Oireachtas back home. I mean, my views haven't changed. I've seen maybe more clarification of some of the issues there, and I'm reassured on some points, but not on others. But you have to take the rough with the smooth in government, and this is an example of that, I guess.
Okay, so this actually sets me up for a question I wasn't expecting, because if we accept it's a trade deal and we accept that we have to honour the existing trade deals and future trade deals, we're looking at Brexit. So by that logic then, that if a Brexit trade deal then says that we should have implement a border for the EU, then Ireland has to adhere to it and the Irish government has to adhere to it.
I think the proposed agreement with the UK, the trade agreement with the UK, and indeed the UK, the Brexit deal covers everything from trade to social issues, economic issues, and so on and so forth. There is a temptation to put the two of them side by side, but the UK is
it's right not a temptation. Like if we say all in this programme for government, then it means all.
I think we're working hard to get the kind of deal with the UK that we want to see, and we're reliant on the European Union to help us with that. The CETA deal has been around, I think, since 2008, so we're 12 years into a deal. Can we put protocols into it, let's say, on sustainability? Maybe we can, maybe we can't. To be honest, I'm very focused on the European stuff, not on what's coming up at home. But I've obviously had a lightning refresher course in CETA over the last week. Myself and Grace O'Sullivan wrote to Eamon Ryan saying, look, can we give this more time, maybe move it into at least January, and hopefully have a little bit more scrutiny. I mean, ideally, I'd love to see an Oireachtas committee consider the CETA deal and look at the good sides of it and the downsides of it. Because I think there are, you know, these things, they are a curate's egg. There's really positive aspects in any deal, but there's also negative sides to it. And I think they need to be fleshed out. And I think that would be useful to the general public. It would be useful to everybody to say, look, on balance, is this worth doing? And it may be that the Greens in government have to say, look, this is just one that we take for the team in order to get the other stuff that we're more focused on, like the climate bill or action on public transport.
We'll come back to that. We'll come back to that climate bill shortly. I know today in the shadow they're pushing back to hopefully to get some amendments done. But nonetheless, I do want to say on the issue of, you know, if we accept this and we say that is the case, the issues we're seeing, that the clarifications that we're looking for, you know, around the investor the investor court, around those protections and around those things. I would put it to you, and I put it to you quite strongly, that your party leader has tried to pull a fast one by putting this on the bill for Tuesday, for yesterday evening. If that was the case, why did they try to put it through without actual proper debate on it, without that Oireachtas committee that you think might be possible? Why did they try to put it through just before Christmas?
I don't know, Tony, to be perfectly honest. I can't keep an eye on the running order of every single piece of Dáil Éireann Seanad business. If I showed you the plenary agenda I'm dealing with in Brussels this week, it would give you a feel for the complexity of what I'm dealing with in the house that I represent. And I guess some things have been floating around for a while. You just want to get them through. And other issues you want to have a lengthy debate on. And I'm simply not party to what the whips are discussing.
Kieran, I accept that. I fully accept that. I suppose it's important, though, that I say for listeners' benefits that it's just, you know, that this was done, and it was done in a way that I think it's Article 29.5.2, which meant that it wouldn't have to go to the Seanad for debate because there was a potential charge on the state. And that potential charge in the state is actually part of the trade deal in terms of Ireland introducing the investor court dispute mechanism. And we have a difficulty there. So, chicken and, for my mind, there's a little bit of a chicken and egg scenario here. And you know, we need to debate that out properly before we decided that, well, we put this thing on the schedule for 4:10 on a Tuesday evening, just the day after Brexit deadline and a day and a week before Christmas. It did seem that the parliamentary party within the Greens, you know, I know members of it are disappointed and upset. Nessa has been quite public about that, and some other members have come out on social media and made statements, but I do think it was handled very badly. I'll put it to you one other thing though. Like, Karen, you've been in government, you've seen how these things do, and you've seen the, as you'd say, you probably have to drink a little bit of from a poison cup that you don't need to to get other things across the line. Have we seen in the last few months several times now where it's been shown where the Greens have been used as a bit of greenwashing to give a green veneer of respectability to some of the decisions that have been made?
It may be, Tony. I think we were courted very strongly in the weeks and months after the election. I think the other parties didn't see that bounce of a vote for the Greens coming through. They didn't think that we would get 12 Dáil seats. And I think when they saw our success in the last general election, or indeed in the Europeans last year, I think they wanted to have us on side. So is it a veneer? Is it a greenwash? Is it something more substantial? Look, I've been arguing this for the last 30 years. I remember the late Charlie Haughey saying, I'm a bit of a green myself. I'm in favour of the whales. And, you know, you and I are old enough to remember Charlie.
Yeah.
We know how far his green credentials went on the environmental end of things, which wasn't that substantial, to be honest. And I think Leo, Michal, I think all of them like to have the Greens on board. And I think we have to be constantly vigilant that we're not just being dragged in to give the veneer of respectability. But on that score, I think there was a lot in the programme for government, which is good from a green perspective. And I think it is, some of it is coming through. It all takes time. But there's a lot of stuff in the programme that I want to see implemented over the next couple of years. And, you know, some of that isn't just, you know, strict environmental green, it's social green. Stuff like the commitments to end direct provision are important, and that will take time to deliver. And other things as well, like the providing leave to remain to thousands of immigrants who are here. I think that's a real positive as well.
I absolutely accept that. We spoke to Brian Killoran from the Immigration Council yesterday about this and about how we hope to see in this white paper and then see some projects, is how I think he put it, where, you know, we see people in the community moved out of direct provision centres and we can do these things forward. And I do think Minister in Charge Roderick O'Gorman has made a lot of really positive noises. I also, my fear is that we've heard pushback from the Department of Housing and from other areas saying, and unfortunately we heard it from the Justice Minister where she made a 2004 sounding that if we do this, there'll be pressure on our health system. Well, I put it to you, Minister, that if we don't do this, we won't have a health service because we are reliant on immigration and a migrant workforce. On balance, it's like you touched on the European election. You romped home, Kieran. The Green Wave was pre-general election. That's the reality here. Do you feel that given that the momentum there, that some of the that your, and I put it to you, that your party leader has failed to grasp the nettle and has not actually gotten enough wins? I agree. I think some of those things are admirable, but it is a weak climate bill.
I think the first iteration of it had its weaknesses, and to be honest, I think there was a rush to get it published in advance of the 100-day commitment that was in the programme for government. I think it took 102 days, but I would much prefer had it taken 150 and to have gotten a stronger draft bill out into the public domain. And I think Eamon would say that to you directly himself. And I think the robust criticism that came from environmental NGOs has been actually really positive because it keeps us on the straight and narrow. It makes it easier for the Greens to sit down with our colleagues in Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael and get a much stronger bill out of this. Because, look, it'll be no picnic. There will be huge pushback on any measure, whether it's in transportation or in agriculture or in construction. You can see the kind of rows we have over putting down cycleways in Dublin, the kind of letter pages of some of our national papers filling up. Saying, I can't believe you're taking away my right to
I'll reference that. Check the Irish Times, guys. It was nearly a quarter page advert. It would cost you a lot of money to get that in the paper if you were paying for it.
It would. But look, even if I were to say tomorrow, let's bring the speed limit down from 120 to 110 kilometres an hour, the soundboard on Joe Duffy would just light up the following day with outrage. So I think we're in a form of denial about the climate crisis that we're in. We're all in favour of climate action unless it impacts, even in the most tiny fashion, on what we see as the freedoms to go about our business. And if you listen to the IFA, if you listen to the AA, if you listen to the CIF or any organisation out there, they'll all be in favour of action on climate in theory, but in practice, wait a second, hold on, you can't do that. And then when you look at the programme for government commitment on a 7% reduction in climate emissions every year, it ain't going to be easy.
Every year and loaded towards the end. Let's be honest on this.
I think it has to be, because I think when it comes to issues like ocean energy, it's going to take about 5 years to ramp that stuff up or to transition even the private car fleet. Nobody's going to jump out and buy an electric car if it's going to be €35,000. So it takes time to go from the kind of the early adopter technology into mainstreaming stuff and making it happen. But I mean, I'm pleased to say a lot of my work in Europe has been about pushing that through the Transport Committee, through the Energy Committee, and I'd love to talk about that as well.
Absolutely. We will definitely get into that. Just one final question on the topic of the day is, do you think CETA needs to be ratified?
I don't. And I would much rather have a robust debate about the benefits and the downsides of CETA. Several countries have ratified it. Several countries haven't. I think the kind of trade deals we're seeing are changing as time goes by. I think the impact of the climate emergency is very significant in terms of how we approach international trade. I do see academic evidence saying that it will actually reduce emissions to have this deal in place. I'm always scratching my head, and I'm always, when I look at Canada, I mean, I love Canada. They're all lovely people, but they have a bucket load of tar sands in the western part of Canada. And I think we're all worrying about that.
And we have a quote from Justin Trudeau that says, you wouldn't leave it in the ground.
Well, you know, I think international leaders are wrestling with the scale of the climate crisis and what to do about it. But Justin, you know, a bit like poor old Barack Obama, they talked the talk in climate, but did they walk the walk? They haven't engaged as fully as they might with the implications of tackling the climate crisis. And look, I mean, in some places like Australia, you still have the climate denial going on, or indeed in the States until, what, another 3 weeks or 4 weeks. But in places like Canada, you have this kind of, the climate is an important issue, and aren't we doing great? And you kind of go, no, you're not.
I'd put it to you, though, that we're like that here, that we are great.
Absolutely. And that's what I'm saying let's say taking something like speed limits or even transforming the agriculture system we have. It's immediately straight into the rhetoric and the passion of we have to feed the world. Sure, we have to feed the world, but I mean, is it full of kind of fillet steak, medium rare, or do we have to think again about the diet that we have, or whether we want to be exporting milk powder to a generation of Chinese children whose genetically may not be best position to take the kind of products that we're offering.
Yeah, I agree that there's fundamental decisions, and I think the last time we met, I had a diesel engine, and now I'm in a hybrid. You'll work on me yet, and you'll get me into that electric, you know.
But
can I ask?
So look, I mean, Tony. In summary, There's an awful lot of stuff that we like about what's going on in government. There's a lot of stuff that we don't like. You do have to take the rough with the smooth. When you're the junior party in government, you actually can punch above your weight, but you do have to take some decisions that you might have opposed, even quite strongly in opposition. And, you know, SATA may well be an example of that. I don't want to prejudge what happens in the Dáil. I can see that some of my colleagues are saying, look, I'm going to vote against it no matter what. Every time you do that, you weaken the amount of political capital that you have in government. And that's the reality. There's only so many times you can say no to something.
Can I come in there? Sorry, and just we finish on this part. We will move on, I promise. But I will say that there's also a framing issue here, whereby I believe, reading the programme for government, that it has been framed exclusively as an internal issue for the Greens to look at. Whereas what's actually happened here is Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have stepped around the they've left in thing that was suitably vague enough for them to say that this is the case, and everybody has just accepted it and then got on with the internal wranglings within the Greens. And that is an issue of framing and an issue of narrative control. Maybe it's a little bit of political naivety as well.
There's nothing the right of centre enjoy more than the left having an internal fight with themselves. Look, I'm old enough to remember the infighting in the Labour Party in the 90s and in Democratic Left and in various other left-to-centre parties over the years. Look, I even remember at our own first convention in 1982, the late Hubie Dwyer storming out, appalled that we were going to contest elections and how could we engage with this system that was corrupt to the core. I don't think the system is corrupt to the core, but I think there is always these internal fights or fights within the left where some are claiming to be more virtuous than others, and that happens on all sides within the left.
It happens on the right as well, but they tend to be much more behind.
They're more discreet about it, Tony.
Yeah, there's a profit motive.
When they're not climbing down drain pipes, but we won't even go there.
Or starting culture wars is the thing that seems to be the new thing. You know, can I ask you, 2020. In the European Parliament, before there was a pandemic, there was talk of a Green New Deal for Europe. As it evolved, as it went on, the situation, we saw targets that were 2030 become 2050, and we saw budgets got slashed in a large way in terms of commitments to spending. And some of the budgets that were slashed are understandable because we have to spend on health at that period. However, how have you felt within the European Parliament that the real wolf that's at the door in terms of the climate emergency has been treated?
I actually think it's a miracle that it's actually quite intact. And I think the rhetoric of the European Union Green Deal is being translated into practice. This is the moment when I start to talk about Europe and everybody listening falls asleep.
Yeah, you need to keep an ear on because this matters.
Yeah, yeah. No, look, I spent 4 hours on last Friday afternoon in one of these trialogues, one of these discussions between the Parliament, the European Council and the European Commission. We were discussing something called the Connecting Europe Facility, a huge chunk of money for energy, for transport and for digital. And the battle I was having with some right of centre colleagues was, do we put the money into roads, into fossil fuels, into business as usual, or do we put more money into renewables? Do we put it into public transport? And we ended up with, you know, we're not quite there yet, but we've a compromise in the middle. The remarkable thing is that 37% of the money going on that is going to go into climate action. Climate action can be public transport, it can be renewables, it can be some of the smart stuff, the digital stuff. This was unthinkable 5 years ago. Under Juncker, it simply wouldn't have happened. Under Ursula von der Leyen, she is pretty committed to this stuff. And in fact, she's getting a hard time back in Germany from her SDP colleagues who are saying, you're going a bit too far in that direction. But there is a coalition in the centre that are happy to see the green stuff happen. For instance, the recovery from COVID. We're putting aside 560 billion. And of that 560 billion, the 37% figure applies. Almost 40% of that money has to go into climate stuff. You might say, well, that's not even a pass mark in terms of climate. But it was, you weren't even in the classroom 5 years ago on this stuff. And in some other funds, it's 60%. I mean, I put a huge amount of time into a report on what we call the renovation wave. I edited this report on how do we get all the buildings we're in up to near zero energy by 2050 and targets for 2030 as well. It got approved. Kadri Simpson, the energy commissioner, said, yeah, I like what you're doing. And we were tic-tacking a lot with Zoom calls and webinars. And essentially, she launched this package and said, yeah, we need to spend 80 billion a year on renovation. So some of this stuff is really is happening. And you're talking about a pullback on the targets. Well, the Parliament said we want a 60% reduction in climate emissions by 2030. The European Council said 55%. But either of those would have been unthinkable a few years ago. So a lot of the green stuff is intact. Is it enough? Will it comply with the Paris Agreement? Does it get us on the right way to exit from the climate emergency? No, of course it doesn't. But for some parties who are absolutely in climate denial a decade ago, this is an incredible turnaround. And I see money going into health, going into COVID measures, going into research, into the Horizon Plus programme. Brilliant amounts of money. We upped that from 80 to 85 billion during the week. These are the kind of rows you don't hear about. You know, the main headline is over Brexit, but I certainly see it in, I see it in transport. I see it in climate action. And you know what? I also see it in bodies like the European Investment Bank. And I don't spend all my time just in the European Parliament. I engage with the European Investment Bank. They're going to put in a new strategy next year with a complete focus on climate. They're going to stop funding airport expansions. They're going to put more money into housing retrofits. So I see this happening in real time of climate finance, green finance actually happening. So I'm pretty optimistic on that score. I mean, I don't want to be a Pollyanna and say it's all fine. We can, you know, close the book and go home. But there is a realization, not just within the Green groups or S&D, the kind of Labour Party equivalent, in the European People's Party. I would engage with somebody like Pernilla Weiss, and she's big on climate stuff. I wouldn't agree with her on issues around migration, but you find common cause on the climate stuff. And one of the interesting things about the European Parliament is it's not just about one crowd in the chamber roaring across at the other crowd. You find these kind of strategic alliances. You try and work in a collegial fashion. So it's very different from the kind of the Doyle or Shannon approach here. It's about cooperation, which on a good day is amazing. I mean, on a bad day, it all falls apart like it always does. But on a good day, you can really.
But what you're saying to me, what you're saying to me is that for the first time, if you're not pushing against an open door, there's certainly a crack. The door is left with a little bit of an opening in it that you might be able to slip through. And, you know, I think that's a good place to come at it from. But I just ask, I saw, for example, Spain deciding to use the European Investment Bank and the funds that have been put aside to rebuild out of the pandemic, to rebuild their economy in a green direction. Like they're talking about creating, I think it's somewhere around 350,000 jobs over like a 5 or 6 year period and just moving into renewables. Should that not be the model everywhere coming out of this?
Well, I think certainly in Western Europe it is. I was opening a conference yesterday morning in Portugal.
It's not here, but yeah, Portugal has a good left-leaning government. We'll go there.
Nice one. And they're talking about this ocean energy stuff big time. So yeah, look, it's happening in the Nordic countries. It's happening in Germany, in the Netherlands, to a certain extent in France and Spain and Portugal. But as you head further east, there's a lot more concern about jobs that have been lost. Jobs that have been lost in coal mining, in gas. And that's why we have this Just Transition Fund. We talk about Just Transition for the Midlands in Ireland, but it's big news in Eastern Germany. It's big news in Hungary and Romania. And essentially, it's, look, if you want us to get away from coal and gas, show us the money. And that's happening, obviously, with people like Orban in Hungary. But it's also happening with some very reasonable people in the other countries that are beside that. And essentially, if we want the transition to happen, we have to pay people to make it happen. But it will happen. Look at the money that is going into Poland. Look at the money that's going to go into Hungary. I mean, we've other issues there around rule of law, around the persecution of LGBTIQ+. We've all of that stuff happening. And, you know, it's funny. When you look at how your original question was, how do we come out of into 2021? If you're Ursula von der Leyen, you're looking at a huge crisis over rule of law in Eastern Central Europe. You're looking at the crisis over Brexit in Western Europe. You're looking at the pandemic north, south, east and west. You're looking at so many other crises that you're trying to deal with. And yet Europe is, the European Union is surviving this. And we're still actually meeting, albeit online, and we're making decisions. We're spending money on the things that we think Europe should be doing.
It brings me on to the last part of the interview, 2021. And I'm going to ask you, domestically and obviously within the EU, what would you like to see? What is Ciarán's wish list look like? And bear in mind that I know you're pretty pragmatic.
I'd like to see an increase in social housing output in Ireland. I mean, we can jump up and down and say there's more housing being built now than in the last 5 years. But look, the numbers in the last 5 years, as you and I know, were only a trickle. There is an enormous challenge in housing, in homelessness and housing in Ireland. Not too many countries in Europe have the degree of a crisis in housing that we have. So I would like to see the government spending more on housing. I think Dara O'Brien is probably more committed to this than Owen Murphy was.
Agree.
But I don't think it'll go as far as I'd like.
Also agree.
I'd like to see the climate bill come through. But instead of the debate about 6%, 7%, 8%, 2050, 2030, I would just like to see the money going into the stuff that will actually make the climate transition happen. That means public transport. It means active travel, walking, cycling. It means moving agriculture away from beef being the only game in town, along with dairy. It means the re-wetting of bogs, this stuff which sounds very esoteric, but it actually means less emissions. I'd like to see energy moving away from the gas and coal into more renewables. Some of them will be on land, and that's hugely controversial, but you know, you need both the ocean energy stuff and the on-land stuff. The ocean energy stuff will take about 5 years to deliver, and you need your interconnectors over to France. And to talk about pragmatics, you know, the more wind, the more cables we join to places like France, the more nuclear we bring in when the wind isn't blowing. So it is a Faustian pact in some ways that we've lots of wind in Ireland, but when the wind doesn't blow, we're dependent on other energy sources. Yeah, well,
I'm actually glad you brought it up, because we, you know, we can ban fracking but import fracked gas. You know, we have these things that
most of us are still driving around in petrol or diesel cars, and will continue to do that for the next decade or more. I think, you know, it was Andrew Montague who said to me a few years ago, the former Labour Party councillor, who said, look, all you ever get in politics is incremental change. But after a few years, you look behind you and you can't believe how far you've come. And I know after 30 years in public life, it is small bits and pieces that over time build up to something substantial. So coming back to 2021, I'd like to see more progress in housing. I'd like to see more progress on the renewable energy side of things. And I'd like to see a stronger push on transport investment that would make us less reliant on the private car. None of that happens overnight, but I think bit by bit you move towards progress in the right direction.
Can I ask you just two questions that you might give me? In terms of the retrofitting of houses and homes, we've seen what are termed low-cost loans that are done. And I would put it to you that they are not low-cost at all. They're actually, the rates are not really that competitive when you consider the interest rates within the EU, the Euribor rates, and the European Investment Bank. And you know, something has to give there. And then the second thing is, you refer to the energy, and we do need to move to renewables. There's absolutely no doubt about that. But do you see energy? Is there a way, a model, or a method that we could begin to see it as a public good, as opposed to, you know, a for-profit model?
Oh, absolutely. And there's a directive for that. There's the Community Energy Directive. And by the end of June next year, people will be able to sell their surplus electricity back into the grid. That has to happen. And I've been assured by Eamon Ryan's office that that will happen. But I think the community energy model is a really interesting one. And if you look at Wallonia in Belgium, they have a system whereby there's a community dividend for every wind turbine that goes up on lands. And there's a lot that we can learn, you know, from the Basque Country in Spain, where there's one-stop shops on how you go about retrofitting your house. And moving on to the retrofitting stuff, you know, if I look around the corner from where I am in Stonybatter, you see St. Brickens Park, a classic Dublin corporation, Dublin City Council, what would have been called senior citizens housing. These two-story blocks, they've been brought up to an A1, a passive house energy performance. That's local authority housing that's been brought to an A1. It's a win-win. It's a win for climate. It's a win in terms of energy use. And it's a real win for tenants who often find themselves living in energy poverty, in fuel poverty. And I think if we're to have this renovation wave, we really have to start with local authority and other forms of social housing first and bring them up to the A1 standard. And I think that will really set us on the right road for the years ahead. Going back to the interest rates, really interesting discussion. But I've been on a kind of a subgroup of the World Economic Forum looking at this, the money for this kind of renovation wave. All these big institutions, the European Investment Bank, the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, the European Central Bank, and then a whole bunch of private banks, they are dying to put money into this. And you and I know that Ireland Inc. or the EIB can borrow money at 0.3% interest rates. There's no reason why we can't do that for the renovation wave. And that just takes Pascal Donoghue in the Eurogroup and his colleagues to say, listen, folks, we want to put the money into the renovation wave. What they want, what the financial institutions want, is certainty. And this is safe as houses, literally and metaphorically. You know what the return is if you can get the heating bills down to 300 or 400 a year.
Exactly. And I want to give this listeners an idea of what we're meaning here. So in effect, like the markets are actually betting on deflation over a decade. So they're saying if we throw 900 million or a billion into something and we get back 900 million, that's all right because we'll have outperformed the market. So what we're saying here is why not take that money and put it into a retrofitting system, a scheme that then actually will deliver you a small return. You know, I'm talking very, very minimal interest rates that will help retrofit and then actually give you, you will actually make a saving because the cost of running your home, like we've had Mel Reynolds on this podcast and he has You know, Mel has the house that actually, I think it's half transformer at this stage. But it, nonetheless, it just makes sense to do that and it's financially the way to do it. You can't bring people with you unless you give them that incentive. No. Just to bring it to a close then. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Only just to very briefly say, the example I always love to use is the CIE pension fund. This is the pension fund for the workers in CIE. It's somewhere between 1 and 2 billion in it. That money is going off into equities and other investments in the European and worldwide market. How about if we could take some of that money and use that to fund the kind of housing and retrofitting that the sons and daughters of CIE workers want? So it's one of the bees in my bonnet is how can we use semi-state pensions, not all of them, but maybe 5 or 10% of that money and invest it in housing here at home. I don't think that's risky. And some countries do it. And I think we should do it here.
Okay. So, Ciarán, last thing, European Parliament 2021. What are you hoping to see?
I have a list on my wall. No, not on my wall. I have a list there in front of me okay. of various pieces of legislation.
For listeners' benefit, that is a very busy piece of paper.
And that's only the environment, the energy and the transport committee. I sit on two out of the three of those. We're going to see the way it works in the 5-year cycle. You get the reports in year one. You get the legislation in year two and three. We're going to see a dam burst of legislation to deliver on this European Green Deal next year. It'll be about pushing renewable energy. It'll be about pushing a just transition. It'll be about essentially looking at the recovery from the pandemic, not back to business as usual, but a move in a different direction. On the kind of files I'm dealing with, the trans-European networks, the energy networks, the transport networks, we have a battle on our hands to nudge or push them in the right direction. But I think you will see a huge amount going into green finance. I think you will see more of a social edge to what the European Union does compared to the previous 5 years. I would be reasonably optimistic that we will see some good laws coming down the track from Europe in the year ahead. As always, it's almost impossible to translate that into simple things that change your life or mine. But I think if you see, you know, your electricity bill having more renewables in it, or if you see scaffolding up on a block of flats with insulation being put on the side, chances are the European Union will be somewhere involved in the policies that make that happen.
Kieran, you mentioned Wallonia. I just want to go back to it at the end. They were the people who gave us the first blocker against CETA. Fair play to them. They punching well above their weight, little Wallonia. Thank you so much.
And the Germans, don't forget the Germans.
I know, but I'm just thinking back when CETA was launched all those years ago. It was Wallonia that caused that stuck the fly in the ointment initially.
Yeah. Look, I in conclusion on the trade thing, I think we all want to see trade, but we want to see fairness in that trade. Everybody has a different definition of fairness, but I think we want to bring social issues and environmental issues more to the table and make sure it just doesn't become the big boys talking to each other.
Yeah, we're not anti-trade. We're anti-trade at any cost. That's how I'd be about it. Kieran Cuff, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. And I appreciate it because I know it's been a tumultuous few days. So we do appreciate it. Talk to you all soon, folks. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.